ultimately my values really stem around fairness and making sure that people have an opportunity to thrive and be able to access things in a way that means that they can be whatever they want to be. So I worked in finance and I loved it. When I started off in finance, I started at the most junior level, and by the end of my career within finance, I was managing a team of 60.
Regardless of what you've done, what you've come from, what you've been through, you had a plan. If you don't, you didn't know what that's going to look like, but you had a plan.
I think I always knew there was more, but I didn't know what that was.
When I look at the younger Joanne, who was in that space of shame and carrying the weight of the world, to the new Joanne, who's just unashamed, owning it completely, what's the difference between both of those two people?
Probably age. So my mom left my dad when I was about 8, and sadly, you know, like many others, I grew up in a family where there was domestic abuse. In my 20s, I had a massive chip on my shoulder. You know, I've been through all of that. Why me? You know, this is so hard. Look what's in your own sphere of influence. You have to go through that process, and all of us, every single person, will go through different things in their lives that will cause them hardship, because I refuse to feel shame for something that I have no control over.
And welcome to Everyday Leadership, a podcast where you get to listen and learn how to lead yourself personally and professionally through the lessons and life experiences my guests share, in the hope that it challenges and inspires you to lead yourself from the inside out and not the outside in. Welcome to another episode of Everyday Leadership. Today I have someone who I met a number of years ago. And you know when you meet someone and your first impression is like, okay, this person is a really nice, genuine, warm person. And there's that hint of curiosity about them. That's exactly how it went for me anyway when I met Joanne Conway, who is our wonderful guest today. And she's someone who, as I've got to know a little bit about, I've just even been more curious about her journey and her story. And we are fortunate enough to have her to come. She said yes to come on the podcast and to delve into that backstory. Joanne, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And likewise, I think when you meet somebody, you can tell instantly if you've got that similar values and mindset. And certainly like the conversations that we were in, and even just the groups that we were with, you could just tell and feel that energy. So yeah, I'm really, really pleased to be here.
And you're someone who's had a very illustrious career, school governor, trustee, guest lecturer, international speaker, currently now the head of inclusion at DLA Piper, previously working at EY, running that D&I team for them as well. And I'm curious, for us to ask you the question, who is Joanne Conway? How would you describe yourself?
Wow, that's a good question. I think I would describe myself as somebody who is, you know, ultimately my values really stem around fairness and making sure that people have an opportunity to thrive and be able to access things in a way that means that they can be whatever they want to be. So whatever that success looks like. So I think for me, that's who I am. I am very driven. I am very, I would like to say, very thoughtful, conscientious. That's something that somebody said to me before. They hadn't met anybody who was as conscientious as me, and I wasn't sure whether that was a compliment or not, because I think that can have pros and cons to it. So I would like to say ultimately that I'm really hardworking, kind, and, you know, importantly, bring people along with me. That's really important to me. I think there's enough room here for everybody. So that's an important part of kind of how I show up day to day and what I do.
Love that. When I think about someone who is kind, conscientious, hardworking, and someone who brings along people with them. And I always like to make that link between who we are now and where we first started out from. So if I went back to a younger you, born in Dublin, around about 8, 9, what was going on for you at that time when you think about your journey?
Yeah, I mean, for me at that age, I was always really curious. I've always been really interested in reading. You know, my mum would say that she would find me like just behind the sofa reading a book. You know, that was something that I was always really, just always wanted to learn, and was always someone that would ask lots of questions, and probably annoyingly to some people, that was who I am. So at that age, actually, although I grew up predominantly in Dublin, I was actually born in Lancashire, which not many people know. But I'm so I was born in a little town called Padiham, near Burnley, and two Irish parents who had moved over. My dad was a labourer working on building sites, and so at age 8, 9, I'd actually moved back to Dublin. So lived in Lancashire till I was about 7. And then at around that time, actually moved back to Dublin just with my mum. So that's when I grew up really as a single parent. So my mum left my dad when I was about 8. And sadly, you know, like many others, I grew up in a family where there was domestic abuse. And that was one of the kind of the big, I would say, not that I knew that at that time, obviously when you're 7 or 8, but it was definitely one of those pivotal moments in my life that you really look back on and see that shaped who you are, how you respond to things, what your values are, what's important. So at age 8 and 9, I was living in a council estate in Dublin with my two sisters and my mum. And yeah, probably out kicking a football around. That's what I love doing. There was loads of, every house had, you know, a couple of kids that lived in it. And, you know, you would call in for one friend, and if one wasn't in, you just moved on to the next house and you kept going until you picked up a few friends. And so I was probably either reading a book or kicking a football.
No, when you describe it like that, yeah, I call them the good old times. I think it's so different for kids nowadays, where it's like, oh, you can call someone on your mobile phone, you arrange to meet up. Back in the day, just go out, you knock on doors. That was that was the fun thing. You don't know what's going to happen, but you're always going to have some fun.
Yeah. And you have people from all age groups. You know, you would have like 4 or 5 year olds and, you know, 7, 8, 10, 12, like everybody would be out. So I think that was, it was a really good times.
Did you have a favorite book that you liked to read at that point in time?
I loved to read Ina Blyton. I loved that book. Yeah, it was I loved it. I loved all of those. I loved Roald Dahl, Ina Blyton. Any books, I would read anything. I don't know. I put a post actually about this the other day on LinkedIn, because you know, you have this memory and you can't remember, like, is that just something that happened where you lived or did it happen in other places? But we used to have this mobile library that would come around to the estate, probably it's a great idea to create that access for people that might not ordinarily get taken to a library. And you never knew when it would come. I'm sure they did have a schedule, but like none of our parents would ever be like, don't forget your library book today. So you'd just walk past and you'd happen to see this big bus, which was a library, and I would be so excited and like run back and try and find my library books, probably like stashed under my bed or something, to bring those back. So whatever I could get my hands on, I read.
So someone who was such an insatiable reader, and sounds like school was a place that you enjoyed, and you had that thirst for learning, you moved to London and you struggled in that change, we saw you end up dropping out of school. What was that for you? What was that like for you? Because it's just such a part of who you are. Letting go of that part and stepping out into the wider world, that must have been quite a hard shift for you to make mentally.
Yeah. I mean, I loved when I was in school in Dublin. I was top of my class. I was, you know, getting A's and B's. You know, don't get me wrong, I was still one of the chattiest ones in the class and getting in trouble for that, but they couldn't really give out too much because I was getting the grades. But when I was about 14, which is, you know, quite a critical age when it comes to exams and getting ready for that kind of next step, my mum actually decided to move back to London and move back to my dad. So that was so I hadn't actually lived with him for 7 years. I'd probably seen him once a year, maybe twice a year over that time. So moving back there, I think having that change of family circumstances, as well as the education system just being so different between Ireland and the UK that, you know, you lose your friendship groups, you lose that connection. We didn't have mobile phones, so you didn't have that kind of, so I really missed my friends and my family back in Ireland, and I found it really difficult to adjust. So I think that's one of the things that I really, I guess, attracted me to this work in inclusion and culture, because the sense of belonging that you can have can really impact you. And I talk about this, and we talk about this theoretically, that, you know, psychological safety and belonging impacts productivity, it impacts on people's well-being, but, you know, I can absolutely attest to that fact that my grades dropped significantly because of that sense of belonging. That was a huge part of kind of me stepping back and not being able to stay on top of it. So yeah, I mean, everything worked out in the end, but I definitely went the long way about it. And yeah, I just ended up going to college. I scraped past my GCSEs, I think I got 5. I think you had to get 5 to go into college. One of those was in drama, and I think I even got like a D in maths, which is ironic because I worked in finance for 9 years. But it wasn't for me at that time. So I guess I didn't feel it at the time that I was letting it go, but I've certainly been pulled back to it as soon as I could do once I got into young adulthood.
Ellen, when you left college and you started working at the petrol station, you got a job doing that, and then you, I guess, rose up to become manager of that petrol station. So, and there's something around when I was reading that, I was like, because a lot of people who, you've lost something that was really, really important to you, which was that learning, that being in that environment. You've moved to a completely different environment. And rather than just feeling down in yourself, it's like, okay, I'm here now. What's the best I can do with this situation? And you rose up. Was that something that you intentionally did? Did you intentionally have that mindset? Or was it something that just occurred and you didn't really think about it?
Yeah, I've everything that I do, I always want to give like 100%. That's just no matter what I do, which can sometimes be, I think, to my detriment, because I take on lots of things and then you're like giving out so much energy. And, you know, it's why I'm doing my PhD at the moment. And it's really difficult, but I'm halfway through and I won't give up. So I've got to, anything I start, I always feel like I have to finish it. Working in the petrol station was a really great opportunity. I think one of the foundations of my career, because it was a really busy petrol station. I had to, have lots of customer services. You had to make sure that you had to, open up on time. You had responsibility from a monetary perspective, making sure that all of the cash added up and everything like that. But this petrol station also, you had to make sandwiches. You had to cook like a cooked breakfast. Like they literally did everything. You had to make bread. So I would be making sure that there was pastries in the oven. I would be timing those, getting those out. So I learned time management skills. I learned how to prioritize. I learned how to manage conflict. I learned how to be responsible, to show up, to be on time, to open a shop, to close a shop. So I think sometimes in society we don't value those roles, but actually the people that are doing those jobs, they are really hard and they are super smart people that are doing those jobs. So I certainly felt like I learned a lot from that.
When you were doing that role, when you first started out, did you think this was it, this is the limit for me, or did you think this is a stepping stone?
I think I always knew there was more, but I didn't know what that was. So I always had this like kind of, even from being really young, I would think I'm going to create a life where I feel content and safe and secure and happy. And that wasn't necessarily a particular job or, you know, a set amount of money that I wanted to make. It was never about that, but I just always had this ambition that I could do more, but I didn't really know what that would be. And And I definitely didn't have people around me saying, why don't you do this? Or have you thought about that? Or you could go back to college, or you could thinking about an apprenticeship. I just didn't have that. So I think that's quite difficult, which is why I do a lot on my socials and just even reaching out to try and kind of bridge that gap, because we don't know what we don't know. So I definitely didn't have a grand plan. What happened when I worked in the petrol station is that somebody came in that was a recruiter where I lived in Ireland. There was a big industrial estate, and they just opened up a big, it was GE Capital Bank actually, so they just opened this big call centre, and they asked me if I wanted to go to like a induction day or to try out. And I said, well, I don't even have a CV, I don't know what that is. And they said, well, I come in here every morning to get my coffee, and I see how you organize everything here, and I see how you have customers, like that's all you need. You don't need to have anything else other than what I see you have. So I went, I applied, I went through like a process, and yeah, I started working there, and did credit control for a couple of years and loved it, learned a lot. Every job I went into, I took as much as I could from it. I volunteered for everything. So when they'd say, we need people to walk around the floor and, you know, take over escalations, or where they needed a manager to speak to, I would just stick my hand up and say, I'll do it. Why not? Like, for me, I was like, this is an amazing opportunity. Whereas I think other people, or some other people, thought, well, I'm not getting paid for that, so why would I do it? I'm just going to show up, I'm going to do my job, and I'm going to go home. And I was in there going, wow, people get paid to do this? This is amazing. Which, you know, I think is, and I genuinely felt like that. I genuinely felt really lucky that this was, and that's when the spark came for me. I was like, there's another world, and I'm going to be part of that. I'm going to work hard to, yeah, because it meant that I could continue to learn. So it might not have been in college or university, but I learned every day by doing different projects and just offering to do different things.
So that was you were able to make that connection back. I think a lot of times when we lose something, we focus on the thing that we lost rather than ask ourselves, what is it that around that thing that I really enjoyed? And for you, it was that ability to be able to learn, that insatiableness to be able to learn and get something new. And you were already doing that at the petrol station, learning those different tasks. But you being in that environment at GE, for you, that's when it clicked, like, no, I love learning. And that's what it is I want to do more and more of.
Yeah, I loved learning, and I learned that I love to pass that on and to coach others. So that's when I started to do more in that space, and I became a team leader. And then when I went on to every job that I went on to, I went just slightly higher, you know, always doing that role kind of side of desk or helping out, and then just getting more confidence and then taking that on and being promoted. And that's how really I progressed throughout my career.
Is there any time that you had any doubts around your ability? Because you can be like, well, I've only got GCSEs, I've got a BTEC, I don't have a degree, and I have all of those different things. Can I really do this? It sounds very much like you had the completely different mindset and approach to things.
No, I mean, I definitely did. There were times when I felt like I needed to have more formalization of it. And I definitely, so when I did, so I did a degree with the Open University, which I started in like my kind of mid-20s. And then that took me quite a long time because I was working full time. And also it was before I had kids and I was in my 20s, so I was also going out quite a lot. So I extended a lot of my deadlines. So it was important to have fun as well. So I did get my degree in psychology through the Open University. But I felt like I didn't get a chance to kind of really do that, like in the lesson kind of learning. It was really hard. I did as much as I could with that degree. So when I went through, when I was working at EY and I worked in finance for 9 years, once I started to move into more of a people space, I really started to think about getting some formal like accreditation to back up, because that is when I started to feel a bit like, how can I move into this role in diversity and inclusion, and I've got all of this lived experience, I've got all of my finance, which is, you know, gives me that business acumen and the strategy and the change management, but I really wanted to, I felt like I was missing that kind of formal education, so I went back and did a master's in HR management and development, and I did that in night school for 2 years when I was doing when I first got my first job in DE&I. So that's kind of where, when I went back into the classroom and realized that I really loved it, did that, said I wasn't going to study again because it was so hard managing work and study, and then 2 years later I started my PhD. No more. I said to my husband, don't let me do anything else. This is it. Once I've done, if I mention it, shut it down.
Went from working in finance for 9 years to moving into that D&I space, you would have faced, I'm sure, some setbacks and some people saying, like, this is two completely different worlds. How can you go from one to the other? How did you navigate that and not let that get the best of you?
Yeah, while I worked in finance, I did project management type roles. So I was managing their working capital, working with the leaders and the accountants, really to help them manage their revenue and their book of business. And so there was a lot of people's skills involved in that. There was a lot of influencing, a lot of, you know, just kind of emotional intelligence and understanding how to really work with people. So I worked hard to kind of to demonstrate that. And then I also took on a side of desk role. So I went, I'm like I said, I'm very, very curious. So as soon as I found out that I could actually move into a formal role within talent, so I worked in finance and I loved it. When I started off in finance, I started at the most junior level. And by the end of my career within finance, I was managing a team of 60 and was responsible for the whole of that department across UK and Ireland. So I was really, really proud of that. And I did that based on building relationships, building trust, credibility, understanding the business and really leveraging that. So I did all of that without any finance qualifications. I'm not accredited from a finance perspective, but I, you know, it takes more than that when you're managing big projects. So I took on a role as the DE&I representative for finance. So I went and I spoke to the DE&I team in EY in the UK, and I said, tell me all that you're doing. What is the strategy for the firm? How can I help? What do you need finance to do? And finance was quite a big team. There was about, I think, about 120, 160 of us all together. So I packaged all of that up. I went back to the finance leadership team and said, these are all of the things that you've been asked to do from a DE&I perspective. I can help you do that. Can I be the rep? And I will work with all of finance to help us execute on all of these things, as well as doing my day job. I won't let any of that go. And of course they said yes. They were like, yes, go for it. Let us know what you need. And I did that. We set up a finance shadow board, which is still going today. And that was, you know, maybe 6-7 years ago. So I was able to demonstrate when I applied for the full-time role that I actually was already doing some things and making an impact in that space.
So there's a very strategic way that you kind of thought about that long-term goal that you had to go to then approach it. I think a lot of times people think it's, I want to move, and then just like that it happened. Whereas there are times where you have to be very intentional, and that intention means slowing things down, creating a plan, and then working on what that plan does. But it's something you've mentioned a number of times where it's been working really, really hard, side of the desk mm-hmm. roles, taking on opportunities that other people have not wanted to take on. What are your thoughts around the whole working hard, and working hard will get you to a particular position? Because I know we talked about like the myth of mediocrity and what that kind of looks like. So I'm curious what are your thoughts, especially with your experience on that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't believe that there is a meritocracy. I think that there are plenty of people that work just as hard as me that haven't managed to get where I am. So I do think there is something around how do we change the infrastructure? How do we make it more accessible, which is what I'm trying to do? You shouldn't have to work that hard, right? It's obviously you work hard, but you shouldn't have to work any harder than anybody else to be able to make it. So yeah, I think that worked for me, but I'm also really cautious around people saying, well, if Joanne can do it, anybody can do it, because that's not the same, that's not fair. Everybody's circumstance is different, and you and there is an element of who you get access to and the sponsors that I've had and the mentors that I've had. So there is a bit of that. You work hard, but sometimes it is about who sees you, who you manage to build those relationships with, and that's not going to be the same for everybody. So I do think it's, and also, you know, working too hard isn't always the best thing for you long term. So like even now, you know, people say to me, like, when is it going to be enough? And that's hard, because when you come from a place where, you know, from when I was 6, 7, like, I knew that what I needed to do was always going to be on me. There is no backup plan. There is nobody else that's going to say, I'll pull you out, or I'll give you this, or I'll help. Like, it's on me. And I was always very conscious of being able to do that and really create a foundation for my family and for my children. And I'm really, really proud of that. But it then becomes hard to then say, okay, right, we're good. Let's not do the 10 million things. We can just do a really good job. And that's the balance.
Would you say you've managed to achieve that balance and you're getting good at saying no? Or is that still a struggle for you?
I would say I'm getting better at saying no. Yeah, definitely. So there are some things now even that I will say, no, that's not for me. Maybe somebody else can do it. Or just no, thank you. Which is hard, or not right now. So there's some things I've been asked to do, and I've said I'll do so on a voluntary perspective, outside of work, outside of my PhD, and I've said I can do that, but it will be September. Does that still work? And if they're happy to wait, then that's good. So yeah, I've definitely got better.
You the other day, this LinkedIn, I shared an article around the difference between joy and happiness, and I talked about joy. Joy is very internal, depending on circumstances, and external depends on circumstances. And when I listen to your journey and to what you've navigated and how you look and approach things, you represent that joy kind of thing, where regardless of what you've done, what you've come from, what you've been through, you had a plan. If you didn't know what that's going to look like, but you had a plan. It's like, I know what I want to do. I don't know what it's going to be, but I know what I kind of want my life to look like. If I then ask you, when you think back to that younger 14, 16, 17-year-old Joanne who said, I don't know what that's going to look like, but I know what it is I want to do. Have you fulfilled that dream yet, or are you still searching for it?
No, it's done. I mean, I fulfill that dream. You know, when I created a safe space for my family, that was my biggest, and that is still, like, I'm so grateful to this day, to every day, like, that's the truth. Every day I say, thank God that I have got a home where I go to sleep at night and I'm safe and I'm happy and my children are safe and happy. That's it. You know, everything else is just the icing on the cake. So for me, it's definitely done. There's always stuff that you want to do from a career perspective, or I always want to do more. I always want to be better, and I always want to serve others more. But in terms of general happiness and whether I've made it, that for me is done. I feel grateful.
So how, if I wanted to tap into my circumstances, my experiences, and use it as a way to help me to look at life differently, have a completely different mindset and approach, what would you share that would help someone to be able to reframe what they've been through, the way that you've been able to do for you?
I think, you know, thinking about what's in your control and try not to worry about what isn't. I think that's one of the biggest things, is what's in your sphere of influence, and let some of the other stuff go. I think sometimes you can't change the past, and you can only deal with what you've got. So that's the way that I have done it. There's some things in my life that I've just gone, okay, that is what it is. And you can't look back, you can't change it. It just is what it is. But what I have right now is this, and taking it step by step. I think taking it step by step is really important. I think it's important to have a vision and to have a goal of where you want to get to. But for me, I always focused on just getting through kind of this small step, but knowing it was going to get me towards something that was greater, whatever that might look like on the darkest days or when times were tough. And there were times like that. I just thought, it will come. I will keep going. I will take a step forward and it will come. And it did. And it took a long, long time. You know, it's patience. Things don't happen overnight. Be patient and be kind to yourself is what I would say.
What is it that you don't, or how is it you did not lose faith? And I think yours in particular is an interesting one, because sometimes people say, oh, I want to become X by this date or X by that date. They have something that they're looking forward to, and therefore they can hold on to that goal. You said that you didn't even know what that goal really was, but yet it drove you forward. So how did you keep the faith and have the patience and the resilience and determination just to keep on stepping forward?
Because for me, there was no way that I was going back to a life that I grew up in. There just wasn't an option for me. So whatever else was out there, it just had to be better than that. So I think I allowed myself that. Maybe for some people that probably felt small, but for me, that was the biggest thing for me was to do that. And whatever that looked like, it looked like.
If you haven't already, can you please follow the podcast? It really helps us grow, and it tells the apps that it's a podcast worth listening to, which the fact that you're listening to means that it is and other people need to know about it. In Apple Podcasts, if you click the three dots in the top right of your app, look for the follow button and click on it. And in Spotify, the follow button should be just below the show's artwork. Now let's get back into today's episode. And I think it's never about, well, for me anyway, it's never about the smallness. It's about recognizing what our drivers are. Like you talked about, yeah. I always say your values influence your behaviors flow into your actions, and then that shapes your mindset. It's like a flywheel that kind of goes around. So you being able to be like, no, I know what I'm holding on to, and I'm moving with that is really, really important. And you mentioned around wanting to influence and impact other people. You are someone who has been very open about your journey, about your past, even about like your essential tremors, your health condition, different things like that. These are things that normally people tend to hide away or has an element of shame around them, but you've leaned heavily into it. Why is that?
Because I refuse to feel shame for something that I've no control over. I just think it's not, and I don't think other people should do too. I think from a societal perspective, we have that put upon us where we should feel that shame, and actually there's power in taking that back and just saying, this is who I am, this is what I've experienced, and actually I'm a better person, I'm a better leader, I'm a better friend, you know, mom, wife, whatever, because of it. So I share because I really genuinely want to encourage people to do the same, and in a way that feels comfortable for them, so that they can step into something that feels right for them. Because for me, it's been really life changing when I have taken. I spent too much of my life, particularly my early years, feeling embarrassed and ashamed, and I just think we shouldn't feel that way for things that are outside of our control. Actually, we should celebrate the fact that we've come through anything and who we are, and if we did more of that, I think we'd have a much better place.
So then if I was to say, when I look at the older, younger Joanne, who was in that space of shame and carrying the weight of the world, to the new Joanne who's just unashamed, owning it completely, what's the difference between both of those two people?
Probably age. I think that's, you know, And don't get me wrong, you know, I in my 20s, I had a massive chip on my shoulder. You know, I've been through all of that. Why me? You know, this is so hard. So I don't want it to come across as being really preachy, like, just get on with it and just, like, you know, look what's in your own sphere of influence. You have to go through that process, and all of us, every single person, will go through different things in their lives that will cause them hardship, or that they will gain power from, or that they will just really be able to it will help them grow. So that's really what I would encourage. So I think it has just been having that kind of that age and what comes with that, and just that kind of, when you've got that family as well, just putting things into context. So I think that's probably been a lot, but age has a lot to do with it. We just get wiser.
Age and wisdom go together. Like, you can't find it. Well, let me reframe that. For most people, it does, because you still need to have the space to be able to actually reflect and learn. Hence why you get wisdom. Whereas there are other people who just keep on going and going and going, and never quite stop and get that pause. And you mentioned, like, growing up and having a family and all that. What have been some key lessons being a mother has taught you?
Goodness. I mean, I just think patience with them, but also patience with yourself, and knowing that, you know, there isn't a rule book, there isn't a right way, and I found just kind of trying to, particularly now minor teenagers, just trying to give them a bit more, just trying to remember, like, that it's tough. You know, sometimes, like, we can be like, oh, why haven't they done this, or why haven't they done that? But actually, it's hard being a teenager, and it's particularly hard being a teenager nowadays. So I'm trying to just pick my battles more and actually just praise them, like, when they do things that might seem small, but actually to them, it is actually quite big. So I've definitely not got it figured out. But I think try not to feel guilty about when you spend, because, you know, you can spend time at work and you feel guilty, and then what I've found is that my career and having that, a career that's given me purpose, hasn't meant that I have been a much better parent. So that's my advice, but I'm definitely no expert. I'm still figuring it out every day.
I actually say I think that's what makes a good parent. A good parent is one that recognizes that you don't have it all figured out. It's all new, you're still learning, because every child is different. I got a boy and a girl, and trust me, so many times I'm like, this one works, this one doesn't work, I don't know what to do. But
and just your friends, like, because that's, like, so many, like, just calls from my friends being like, oh my god, I don't know what to do, like, what, and they're just like, yeah. So just have your, like, your little friendship group to keep you going, to get through it, because that's important. We have to make sure that we look after ourselves as well.
How much time do you take to pause and look after yourself, and how that downtime for Joanne?
Probably not enough, but, you know, I do I go for walks, and you know, just even, like, having conversations with friends and stuff. So I do try, and that's where I get my energy from. And also with studying, so sometimes if I study I might go to the library for the day, and for some people that might feel like a pain, but for me, actually, that gives me energy, where I just, like, have no distractions. It's just me and my books in the library. That's a really good way for me to restore my energy, so I do quite a bit of that.
So how do you know when it's time to say goodbye and walk away? You spent almost 17 years at EY,
throughout,
which is absolutely amazing. It's a lifetime for some people. And then you moved into your new role. That must have been a difficult choice for you to make.
Yeah, massive. I mean, I grew up at EY. You know, I joined as a young, kind of early 20s, no formal education. I hadn't completed my degree at that point. I had no, you know, no husband, no babies, no, like, I've been through so much and learned so much and been really grateful. There were, you know, some times where I had just things going on, and they were really, really supportive, and that's why I stayed so long. So I still very much love for the company, and in contact with a lot of my old colleagues and friends. But it just felt like it was time for it to do something different and to have a change, and speaking to DLA Piper, their values really aligned with mine, and I could see that there was work that could be done and that I could make a real impact there, which is why I've moved. So yeah, I'm really excited to see kind of what the next couple of years are going to bring, and my PhD is based in professional services. Excuse me. So I'm luckily for me, I can straddle then across the law industry and the legal industry and the accountancy professional services firms as well for my studies. Yeah. So I don't know when the answer is. I think for every individual, it is really different. And it's something that you have to make for yourself. But I would say that just trust in yourself and take the step, because I think sometimes we're a little bit afraid of taking a step, and you don't have to take a leap or, you know, like a big step. You can take a little step. So enough that you feel, you know, that you're learning and that you're stretching, but not so much that it's terrifying.
You ever taken a step that saw you slipping and falling and failing and it felt like the end of the world?
Oh God, yeah. I mean, yeah, definitely. I mean, there's been, particularly I think in, like, when I was moving from finance into DE&I, into the talent space, I applied for lots of roles within EY at that time to try and kind of move into that space, and was unsuccessful. And for me, I felt that was really difficult because I'd been used to always overperforming and always being this. And I would apply for these roles and they were like, no, not quite right. And I was like, what? What is going on here? And I stepped back and looked. And actually, when I got the feedback, obviously, I was devastated. But when I got the feedback, it was fair and it was constructive. So I think for me, being able to step back and just see that has been, yeah, really important. And a good lesson for me, because if everything's too easy, then you're not learning. So it's good to have that challenge.
Teach you to be able to come to that space of reflection, because I know I've definitely felt it. I worked with some clients who felt it as well. When you get that initial feedback and then know the ego, and it's like, what did you, like, there's so much emotions that you go through that can be a challenge for some people to actually take that step back and be like, no, this is fair, I need to do some more work, as opposed to they're out to get me, or they're not helping me out, or it's someone else's fault. So how was that for you?
I mean, quite early on in my career, I got some really good constructive feedback, which was, you know, sometimes you can be a little bit defensive. And my reaction was, what do you mean? And then I realized, as I said it, I was like, oh, okay. And that came from, I just wanted to do my best. I never wanted to let anybody down. So I really had to check myself on that. So that's been really good. And I've kept that as my kind of sense check as I go through things now, is that if somebody's giving you feedback, like, just listen. You don't have to take it all on board. Sometimes people just love to give feedback and it might not be relevant, and that's fine. It's your choice whether you take it on board or not. But sometimes people give you some really good, like, constructive feedback that you can learn from that makes you better. And I really did take that feedback on board. That was probably like 10 years ago or more. But I always have that in the back of my mind, of making sure that I'm not like that. If somebody's giving me feedback, if somebody's putting something forward, listen, really listen. Don't go with your own preconceived ideas. Even if you've got an idea, be open to others, because it might be better for yours. And don't be too gracious. You know, don't be too kind of... let the ego get in the way. I've often said, your idea is better than mine, let's go with it. Like, the most important thing is we get there, is what's the end result, what are we trying to achieve, and then how we get there doesn't really matter. Like, it is important that you are open to that feedback. So yeah, it's definitely hurts, but once you dust yourself off and you really listen to it, then that's probably how I've grown the most. I asked for loads of feedback. I was like, tell me what I can do better next time. There must be one thing that I can do better. And that has helped, because it gives people that permission, because people can feel uncomfortable about telling you where you haven't done something right. So offering that out to them and saying, it's going to really help me if you tell me one thing I can do better. And then people are like, oh, okay, it's going to help you then. Yeah, here, actually, you didn't do this great, or this could be even better if.
You're someone that's found it easy to build trust with people, because for people to be able to feel safe enough to give that feedback means you have trust, psychological safety, with different bits and pieces. So that's something that you've always done really, really well, or is something that you had to be intentional about when you're working with other colleagues or teams you've led in the past?
That's one of the things that I pride myself on. It's one of my strengths, is I do build trust quickly. And I do that through sharing. I think, you know, through being vulnerable as a leader as well, being authentic, doing what you say you're going to do, meaning what you say, following up with things. So building trust quickly is something that I think it's one of the most important things that, you can do as in a team. So yeah, definitely that's something that I've worked hard at, and I've really seen the benefits from that.
So what are some of your other superpowers, some of your other strengths that you've picked up over the years?
I'm a good problem solver. So I don't panic. So if there's a problem, if there's something that needs to get fixed, whether it's seen as being kind of critical or, you know, I'm quite good at pragmatic, at just taking a step back and saying, okay, let's just start from the beginning. What's the problem? What are we trying to do? Who do we need to speak to? How do we need to mitigate the risk? What's the kind of crisis points? So that's something that I've been really good at, even when I worked in finance. It's one of my natural skills, I would be, is to kind of have that problem solving, and I'm a good connector. You know, I'll say, oh, you should speak to this person, or I've heard this, you should talk to that person. I think that's an important part of it. And also, you know, doing what you say you're going to do. I'm very loyal. I'm very supportive of my team. I'm a team player. If you're in trouble, you need something sorted, I will do my best to help you out. And I think that builds trust quite quickly, because people start to see you as somebody who is genuine and somebody who is not just out for themselves. And that is really important to me. So, and I've definitely seen the benefits of that in relationships at work as well.
See, I love what you said there. I think one of the things around being the person who does what they say they're going to do is something that's so simple and so easy, but doesn't happen a lot, yet is one of the key things to actually building trust with your people, because they know that I can rely on you. You do actually have my backing of just saying it. So that's a really, really great example. So how have you then, can you mention earlier on around also having sponsors and mentors and different things like that? Are you an introverted person, extroverted person, if you're looking at personality types, and how have you been able to build those mentors or get sponsors to help you on your journey?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely, I would say I'm extroverted. I think sponsorship I haven't really asked for. I think that's something that more is given, like gained through building relationships and trust. Mentoring is something that I really value. It's something that I really found helpful, and I still have mentors today at all different levels, and I mentor quite a lot of people, you know, from people that I've mentored for years, people that I've mentored for one-off piece of work, people that I mentor, you know, for weeks, months, whatever it might be, because I've seen the value in that. And I know I've, particularly when I worked at EY and I was building up my career, I definitely would go out of my way to ask people. So we had a really good system called Mentor Match. You could log on a system and log yourself as a mentor or a mentee, and you could look and see. So I remember looking when I was in finance and saying, who works in HR? Because that's where I wanted to work. So I was like filtering. I was like, okay, who's in HR and who's based in Manchester? And I think there was only a couple. And so I reached out to this person who at the time was like about three levels above me, and through the system. So I think that's important, because you've got the system, you feel like you've got permission. I probably would never have reached out to this individual if it hadn't been on this system. And then once we got connected, and I'm actually friends with her now, and she will tell you that I was the most persistent mentor or mentee that she ever had. So I would meet with her and she would say, oh, you know, maybe do this online course or speak to this person or do that. And then, like, you know, a month later, I'd come my my catch up and I'd be like, done them all. Here's all things I've done. I've done them all and I've done extra. What else? So she was like, I was like the best, but also the hardest, because I was just constantly like, okay, what's next? Because I was just so conscientious and I just thought it was such a great opportunity that I was like, I'm not going to let this person down. They've given me some advice. I'm going to absolutely maximize it. So I think there is a real importance in mentoring and giving that back. So sponsorship is really important. We know that, you know, women and any underrepresented groups are typically over-mentored and under-sponsored. So I'm a big fan of sponsorship where it can be given, but, you know, mentoring is something that can be given as a gift at any time, and you can't underestimate how much of a difference that you can make for someone, even if it's one piece of advice, one 20-minute conversation. So I, that's something that I've benefited from, and I'm really trying to pass it on.
I think about you passing things on, my mind goes back into something you said around always wanted to make an impact. Was it a full circle moment for you, being both a lecturer at university and a school governor, when you think about you leaving the school the way you did?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's really interesting, like what you imagine. So I remember there's a good friend of mine, and I worked with him for years at UI in Dublin, and, you know, we've both left now, but we still keep in touch, and we were talking about, we're both big geeks, and we'd be talking about like all these different like books and philosophy and different things, and I said, I always wanted to be a teacher. And he was like, well, you could still be a teacher. And I was like, no, I can't, like, it's impossible, because I'm the maid breadwinner in my house, and it, like, I couldn't go back to that. If I wanted to be a teacher, it would be like a massive step down in salary. I just never imagined it. And then he was like, well, you just never give up, you never know. And I said, oh, okay. And then when I did my master's, I did my one of the modules was on diversity and inclusion, and the professor at the time said, I'm not going to lecture this class in front of you, like, you're ahead of D&I, like, I'll do the academic side of it, but why don't you bring the business side of it? And I was like, yeah, I can do that. So she taught on the academic side, and then she said, Joanne, can you tell us, like, what would this look like in practice? So I did, and then that's where she was like, when you finish your master's, you should think about teaching a module on this, and I did, and I got, like, so I, you know, I know it's like cliche to say, you know, your dreams can happen at any time, but, you know, I was in my 40s, I was like full sure that I would never get to be a teacher, so I was I was absolutely thrilled. And sometimes it happens in a way that you don't expect it. So I'd imagined it in this really linear, having to go back to school, retrain as a teacher, working in a primary school, and actually I had this other opportunity that came up in a completely different way. So you just never know what's around the corner and kind of what step, as you move forward, what it's going to open for you.
So you've achieved your dream of being a teacher or a lecturer. You've created an environment for your family that's sustainable, that's amazing, that's different to what you had, which is what you said you wanted to do. Are there any other dreams or goals that you still want to accomplish?
I want to finish my PhD. That's something that I definitely want to do. Hopefully next year, I'll be finished that. So, you know, Dr. Conway, that's probably the next dream.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, that's the next one. Although my kids, my teenagers remind me I'm not a real doctor. That's fine. So I think that, and, you know, maybe I'd like definitely like to publish an article in an academic journal. That would be amazing. So, yeah, I've still got some things that I want to do.
You ever write a book?
Yeah, possibly. We'll see what comes out of this out of this PhD. I mean, literally, the submissions that I've been making on this, it's pretty much would probably be a book in itself. So, yeah, maybe.
And some of the things you're hoping to gain personally from doing the PhD and then to pour out into the world through the research and what you're going to create?
That's a really good question. It's the some of the things that I've seen around how the distribution works around wealth, around health, around education, around work opportunities is something that I've always felt really strongly about. How do we redistribute that, and how can we really make an impact that's tangible? So that's why I did it. I was really interested, particularly on the topic of privilege and inclusion, on why, if people really understand how we are all privileged, all of us has privilege and all of us lack privilege. You know, it's a social construct, and it will change depending on the circumstances that we're in. So we all have it, and we've all lack it in different ways. And if all of us understood that, then would we be able to look at things in a different way? So would we be able to, coming back to the piece where I said, knowing, being able to take feedback and being able to be reflective and being able to say, actually, do you know what? I probably could have done that differently. Imagine a place where everybody understood that we all have different amounts of privilege, and we have an opportunity to make sure that we redistribute that so everybody has equal opportunities, which results in equitable outcomes. Imagine when people look at the way that they set up a system in work, or they design a program, or they think about something, that they think, I'm not sure whether that will work for everybody. It might work for me, but have we really thought about how this will work for people that are not like me? And what can I do then to just change that? So it's not about giving somebody extra. It's just about how do we make sure that when we're doing things from the beginning, that we're doing them in a way that will be more accessible, more equitable to all of our employees, all of our communities. That's really what I want to, the impact that I want to have. So if I can provide the evidence and come up with a framework that's practical and easy for people to really go through that process, and then have that empowerment to be able to make real differences in their lives and in the workplace, then that's what I want to achieve. So wish me luck.
I don't need to wish you luck. I know you're going to be amazing at it, because you have that insatiable thirst to actually get this out into the world. When I listen to you describe of the reason behind, the rationale for you, it also very much, and this is just to me, you can correct me if I'm wrong, sounds very much like utilizing what your experiences were and being able to, you almost have this cliche, diamond is made by very fine and fire and all that kind of stuff. It sounds very much like that. It's, you know what you went through, and you can take that experience and actually create a framework that other people can be able to walk through a lot quicker, to see themselves and then come out on the side a lot quicker than you had to go through without some of the challenge that you went through. And that, for me, I think is such a important and beautiful experience of just refining ourselves as human beings and refining our experiences as human beings, and then being able to pour out something different into the world to help other people live different lives. And it's powerful.
Yeah. That's what I'm hoping to do, and that's what I will do, and that's the I think that I'm in a great position, and I am in a position of privilege, actually, in the role that I have, the networks that I have, the exposure that I have to different groups, to be able to use that platform to influence change for real good, and that's what I really want to do.
I guess my last question to you would then be, how do you define leadership?
Leadership for me is about getting the best out of every single person on your team and bringing that together in a way that collectively means that you can do great things, that you can execute on what it is that you want to do, so that you have... that you can really show the outcome and the impact that you're making as a team. But for me, leadership is about serving others. I say to my team, I cannot be successful. There is no point in me, sitting in a performance review and talking about all of the things that I've done if my team is not performing. If my team is not happy and engaged and feeling like they can show up to work, do good work, feel proud of what they do, understand the impact that they're making, then I'm not being a good leader. So that's, for me, is about leadership, is individually understanding your team, understanding them as humans, their skills, their experiences, what makes them excited, and then bringing that together, because you'll then have a mix of skills and experiences that you can work together to really create change.
This is why we get along so well.
Yeah, you know, it's not that. I was speaking to someone the other day about this, and for me, leadership is not complicated. It really is about, particularly when you're a senior leader, it's less about you and it's more about your team. And I think the more that you think about that, the better. I want to make sure that each member of my team is successful. And if they are successful, then I will be successful. If they're not successful, I'm not successful. So, you know, I think we don't need to overcomplicate it. It does take time, energy, and you have to talk about things that are not just deliverables. You know, people wonder why their teams don't perform but don't actually put in the work to just really get to know them, because if you don't know your team, then you're not going to know what's going to get them motivated. And then, you know, so you shouldn't be surprised if things don't work out. So I'm a big fan of investing, set the foundations, and then you will reap the benefits. And I've seen it time and time again.
It takes time and sometimes can feel painful in the short term, but it's so, so worth it. 100% agree with that. This has been a pleasure. Just your journey, unpacking your mindset, your mentality, how you just navigate it throughout the different obstacles and hurdles all the way throughout to what you're doing right now. For me, there's a lot of takeaways from this that I know I've definitely taken away, and other people listening to will be as well. And so thank you. Thank you very much for sharing your story. Thank you very much for just showcasing that there's so many things that we go through that we don't have to be ashamed of. And once we own that side of things, it takes away the power of that shame away, as well as everything else that you've just shared today. So I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This is Everyday Leadership. We'll see you all next week. While you're still recovering from that amazing conversation, let me give a quick preview of what we got coming up next week. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss out.
He basically gave me the playbook and I was like, whoa, wow. So this is the workplace 101. This is the stuff I should learn. This is the stuff they should be teaching. Like this is the thing. Like, okay. So I had like seen it and been like, I get it. And I realized in that moment, there was just a lot of things came together for me. I realized actually you have all of the skills and the interests to be extremely successful in this career. But you also have other things that you want to do, and there's space for that. You can, you know, work was no longer a hard place. It was now an enabling environment. So my perspective changed a lot.